Good morning. Welcome. Thanks for coming. Title of this talk is basically our jobs are changing. Can we keep up? Who am I? My name is Mandy Walls. I am currently the technical practice manager at OpsCode. We make a configuration management product called Chef. What my title sort of means is that I set technical expectations for the professional services team. What I actually do right now is wrangle the calendar, but you know, it is what it is. I've been a sysadmin for a long chunk of time, and I came into the field in Linux and moved into web operations. So for folks who are active in that space, I have been working with O'Reilly's Velocity Conference about web operations for a number of years. You can find me pretty much anywhere as LNXCHK. I've had that handle 15 years, and I keep hoping that somebody will battle me for it on a new system, and sadly, no one ever does. So that's me. So the things that I'm not going to talk about, and part of this, just to sort of assuage any fears or trepidation, I'm not going to talk about Chef. I can talk about Chef and our products, you know, forever. I talk about them every week, and there's actually one of my very capable coworkers is running a Chef training all day here. I'm also not going to talk about DevOps. Although some of the things that I will touch on sort of start to smell all wibbly-wobbly, DevOps-y and part of it, but there are other venues for that where that conversation happens. I'm also not going to talk about gender and diversity. And occasionally I get called out for this, and I really just want to say there are other forums for that. So for right now, I really just want to talk about our future, right? Yours, mine, ours together, ours as a field of expertise, as a profession, as a group of people wearing the sort of sysadmin moniker, and where things are and where I hope that they're going. I'm also going to touch on some things about the world in general, right? Because we are not independent players. We're not working in a vacuum. The things that we are doing are affected by the world and the way that it's changing. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit, too. If you could leave your questions to the end, that'd be great. We can have a conversation about some of these topics. There'll be plenty of time for that. So why I care? The truth is I work for a vendor, right? And we don't make a gigaw or, you know, a little thing you hold in your hand. We make a framework that, from the baseline, assumes certain knowledge and certain practice of the folks that we hope will be using it and will be successful with it. And as part of the organization I belong to now, I get to talk to our customers. And our customers are everyone from small web shops to the Fortune 500, right? So on a regular basis, I am talking to customers. I'm talking to managers. I'm talking to director-level folks in all of these organizations. And I hear the same thing week after week after week, in that, you know, they don't have enough staff. They don't have the people that they need to get the jobs done. And I know those folks are out there. I know they're here this week, right? And that what I have started to unfortunately see more of is that our brethren and sistren in arms are sort of self-selecting themselves out of modern practices. And I want to, you know, sort of take a step back and take a look at that, because it helps, and obviously commercially it helps us, right? If I know that the people on the receiving end of my product are skilled and engaged and excited, then they're going to be successful with my product. But just in general, like wearing the moniker of sysadmin and, you know, being a representative of that field and building, you know, more positive experiences and better skill sets, it's all part of sort of being in the place and the time that we are. So I want to roll back the clock a little bit not too long, right? But just talk about, you know, how we got to where we are. And some of the legacies that we have as systems people revolve around the lowest level Moore's Law and the improvements in the platforms that we're working on, and also in the cost and the capital investments that were required for previous generations of systems. In the past, our job was to protect these expensive, specially purchased boxes that ran one application, two applications, or maybe a subset of our business. They were incredibly capital-intensive investments. We ran the stuff, we fixed the things, and that was kind of the end of our interaction with the rest of the organization. And you see that echo in like TV shows like the IT Crowd, right? You've got two guys sitting in the basement working on some stuff, and when they pick up the phone, they ask if anybody's turned it off and on again, and then they hang the phone up, and that's kind of the end. Part of this was driven by monetary investment, right? That relationship of cost to use was pretty high. Machines and the networks of storage, specially built, specially purchased for a particular use case, all of that sort of capital investment. So the behaviors that were encouraged are, you know, protectionism. They're, you know, being the gatekeeper around these resources that were very expensive and bought for a particular purpose. The higher those costs went and the higher they stayed, the greater the risk of failure is for new systems, for new additions to the business, for all these sort of expansions and experimentations that that we could see. Cost impacts the attitude and behavior and created the whole culture that we're sort of notorious for of being, you know, the purveyors of no. The folks that you ask them to do something or you ask them if you can have X, Y, or Z, the answer is always no. And there's a reason for that, right? You have the sort of economy of scarcity where there's only a certain amount of resources available. They were specially purchased for a special project, and no one else can have access to those systems. So we're protecting basically the sanctity of all these resources, and IT capital, you know, sort of became the job for folks on the front line. Systems administration, there are folks that watch the blinking lights every day and make sure all this money that was spent is still protected. So we built up this generation of no, and sort of you've got these sysadmins that were rewarded for, you know, protecting these investments. They're hoarders of information because they feel like that adds to their own personal value and their own, you know, sort of internal capital. And we built up the bastard operator from hell and sort of worshipped these people, right, as the arbiters of behavior in our field. And we all know these folks. We may actually be or have been those folks. I certainly have been a jerk and in places where I've worked about, you know, people who want something done. The way forward, though, is not to be proud of running junior sysadmins in circles looking for obscure documentation or stuff about proprietary systems or, you know, demanding all of these sort of diva-esque things be available for the systems guru, and we'll talk about that. What you want from a field is progress. We want to be able to move forward. We want to be able to do new things, enable new ideas. And part of that is standing on the shoulders of giants, of learning from the people who came before us. And the prior generation, that legacy attitude where information and resources need to be hoarded, prevents this, right? And almost to the point where you feel like you're just trolling the next generation, right? Like, good luck figuring that sucker out, man. Like, I had to figure it out from the code, like you have to too, right? And you end up having folks spend a lot of time reinvestigating, re-experimenting, basically rediscovering all of the knowledge that had already previously been discovered, simply because it wasn't shared or written down. If you look at mature fields, though, that's not the way they behave, right? Car manufacturers aren't ignoring 100 years of history with cars and the internal combustion engine when they bring out a new vehicle. Sometimes you have paradigm shifts, electric vehicles, those sorts of things, but it's still essentially a car, right? If you're talking more about, you know, civil engineering, bridge building, there's, you know, years of history of material science, load-bearing structures, the experimentation on, you know, triangles and geometry and all of these things that mature systems and mature fields are relying on. So we're still at the sort of the cusp of how we get to that point with our field, right, as systems administration. Part of this has been tough because of specialization. Over time, complexity has bred specialties, right? Some folks went into networking, and they became network engineers. Some folks went into storage and are kick-ass SAN engineers. Other folks specialize in data center operations. You know, they can cable the living heck out of your hut and cold rows, and everything looks beautiful, and everything's labeled. You have web operations folks, you have IT, back office people, all of these specializations. The federation of these tasks can create positive outcomes. Like, you want your storage people to know storage from soup to nuts. You want them to know exactly what best products to buy. You want them to know how things are performing, how to get the best bang for your dollar out of your storage. But at the same time, it creates sort of a federation of IT practice where there's less and less incentive to share knowledge, share ideas, talk to each other, you know, build those sort of end-to-end synergies and keeping everyone on goal. And I see this a lot, unfortunately, in large organizations where I'm working with one team of people who are application engineers or whatever the case might be, and they need something from another team, and it's weeks of procurement and talking through tickets and never actually speaking to the person on the other end of that ticket queue. So those silos that get built up start to hurt us, right? And here again, we're not the only ones who specialize, right? So if you're talking about, you know, medicine has lots of specializations. You have cardiology, you have gastroenterology, you have dermatology, plastic surgery, you even have specialization by age, right? Your pediatrician versus, you know, geriatric practice. Like, all of those things, people start to specialize so that they can better serve you. And but part of your cradle to grave life, right? You want them to be knowledgeable about you as an entire human being and how everything you do affects your health. At the same time, when we apply that same holistic to our jobs, that entire picture gets lost, right? So talking about evolution of practice over time and coming out of the sort of reign of terror of the bastard operator from hell, there are published papers on how professions and practices, how they emerge, how they evolve over time. One in particular, written by Mary Shaw in the 90s, actually, was specifically about prospects for an engineering discipline of software. And if you've been in the field a while, you know that software engineers have sort of appropriated the title engineer. There's special meaning to the word engineer, and there's, you know, tests to take, certifications to have, and a certain level of expertise is assumed. And it's troublesome that software engineering has sort of borrowed that word without borrowing all of the other meanings that come with it. But underneath that, you have this how you get to engineering, right? How you get to being an actual legitimate profession. And it goes through Mary Shaw breaks out three basic stages. And the first one is the craft stage. And this one, you have sort of talented amateurs. You have a lot of use of intuition, things that feel like they should work, things that feel like they work for me, right? Here's your sort of autodidacts and your self-taught sort of practitioners who are, you know, experimenting, they're looking at things from sort of childlike lack of experience almost, so that they're, you know, bringing sort of an interesting perspective onto it. Early tools in these fields built mostly for their own personal use, right? So if you think back to, you know, the years that you spent slaving away on Solaris boxes and the shell scripts that you had to manage all of those things that you handcrafted because you couldn't find what you wanted on Big Admin or whatever the case might be, all of those things are sort of reflective of that early stage, that craft stage, as people are still exploring the potential of the things that they're working on. There aren't best practices, there aren't journals or blogs or things to refer to. There's maybe a loose collective of people who are working on these same things that are maybe sharing a bit of detail. Over time, you enter what Shaw determines as the commercial stage, and this is where the value of the work being done in the field is attached to some kind of economic reward, right? Where there's market expansion, there's actual demand for the work that's being done. Rather than it being, you know, someone in the corner knitting tea cozies or whatever the case might be, you have this field emerging where there's standard practices that start to emerge. The practitioners are more carefully selective. They may have some sort of formal or maybe informal training or an apprenticeship or some kind of relationship that builds up with the field. The final stage, she determines, is engineering stage. And this is where you start to apply scientific principles. And you start to know, you know, exactly how much load a particular structure is going to be able to bear across a certain span of for a bridge or something. You get first principles that start to emerge. You see that experimentation takes on a more sophisticated tenure, where people know what's already been done and they're building on more and more sophistication over time. You start to find that there's a more dedicated pathway for training as well. So you're bringing in folks and you're training them up in these, you know, first principles and these very key procedures and points. So having said all of that, and particularly around the field of software engineering, as that's changed over the years, you know, where are we, right? Where are we as sysadmins in this stage? I'm not sure, right? Like, the folks that I talk to every week, they're maybe at every different stage, right? And there are aspects of our field where people have tried to sort of paint this in a different light, right? You have like ISO standards that try to codify some of these things, right? Where you are at one level, these are your common practices, and the next level, you really need to achieve these practices. And it's the same sort of evolution towards repeatability and reliability and predictability, really. One of the most interesting ones that I work with on a regular basis is actually in the back of Jez Humble's Continuous Integration, Continuous Delivery book. There is there's a table for the evolution of operational practice around delivering software, and starting out at that sort of craft stage where everything's hand-turned, artisanal systems, hand-built, you know, packages that get deployed, and then you work your way up to through the goals of like repeatability and stability and, you know, metrics and monitoring and all of these things that start to apply science to your actual system. And the goal being at the end of their book that you should be able to deploy certain applications as often as you want to, right? But you have to meet all of these sort of intermediate steps. And it's a really interesting way to sort of boil down all of the tasks and all of the requirements that go into running these sort of complex systems that, for those of us who've been around a while, don't even think about them anymore. We just sort of do them. There's muscle memory involved, right? And we know where we are. There's science emerging, right? Like Mark Burgess, like, he's very much a scientist, right? This is my last talk of the year, so like my next like hobby is working through his new book, right, which is like a billion pages. It's going to be crazy. It's going to take me an entire quarter. to work through it. But folks like that are starting to build science, right, around what we do and push us into that next stage. There are challenges, though, to moving forward, right? We know that unskilled workers hold organizations back. When you think about, you know, working in teams, and even when you're talking about kids at school, right, and you have a team that's doing your physics experiments in lab, right, the team only moves as fast and only really gets through the project as quickly as the slowest grasping kid sort of gets it, right? So the idea that you have people on your team who don't have all of the skills that they need to help you get work done and get your goals met is super hard, right? Super hard to deal with. It's definitely a challenge for moving from unpredictable, fat-fingered, copy-paste things and into more mature processes. Investing in training and professional development is super hard, right? Training's expensive. Good training is priceless, but I will totally charge money for it. There are different aspects to it, right? There's the individual contributor who's a curmudgeon, doesn't want to learn anything new, isn't convinced that this thing you've brought in is even worth their time, and they're just going to be a pain in the butt. There's also management hesitant to invest in people who might leave, right? And you see that sort of reflected in, I will pay for this training, but you have to stay a year. Like those sorts of handcuffs that are very common in corporations when training is even actually available. Hiring in itself is a whole other ball of wax. Hiring for, on the management side, hard to find people who have that right set of skills and are willing to come work for you, but also from the interviewee, the employee side, folks coming into the field who have no experience. How do they get experience? How do I get a job with no experience? How do I get experience with no job? All of those things, and then how do you make the investment to train yourself and pay for these things, and all of this all gets rolled together. And it's emotional, right? Because there's a social cost, because you're spending your time taking training. There's also monetary cost, because all of it costs money. And there's a lot to think about when we're talking about, some of the training and skills that I'm going to talk about later in the deck. If you're trying to do it yourself, internally, bringing individuals up to speed is a super tough job. We're bad at it, like terrible, seriously. And part of it is the nature of the job, where it's one person sitting at a keyboard doing things. Part of it is that, whether it's cause or effect or whatever the cycle is, that systems administration and some technologies in general sort of attract the people who are whose interpersonal skills are maybe not as strong as they could be. It's hard. It's hard to figure out. Like, we are not we're not skilled in pedagogy, right? Like, I didn't study education. So working towards groups of people who some may be auditory learners, some may be visual learners, some may be tactile, I have to do this to learn it kind of learners. All of those sorts of things, when all you really want to do is hire this new dude and bring him in and have him be useful. Like, that's a lot of baggage to have to deal with. One thing that we've seen over history for professions, the idea of apprenticeships and journeymen and all of these sorts of things that we haven't really embraced, that are probably worth a look, right? When you give a new person a few months to come on board and learn some things and sit with you and see how everything works, and sort of get that feeling for not just the work being done, but also the company culture and what your expectations are of them as a person and an employee and as a team player and all these other things, all this other extra baggage that gets rolled up into those sorts of things. It's super tough. And when you get to the point where you are so busy with the day-to-day, making time to do something like this is like asking someone to eat an elephant, like, it's just absolutely impossible to even comprehend. So in the meantime, while you're trying to figure out all that stuff, like, there's new things coming at you, right? There's new technologies to be learned, there's new platforms, like, somebody's patching a kernel, it doesn't work, and, like, all this other stuff's flying around. And not only are we trying to teach new people and bring them on board and make our practices better, we're trying to learn new things. And it's constantly, constantly changing. In order for our organizations to grow and improve, you know, for our customers, for our stakeholders, like, we have a lot of weight on our shoulders to make sure that anything that's coming out of the product team is going to be well supported and well maintained and well run. At the same time, I'm so exhausted, I have this new person, and you're being pulled in a million different directions. So it's hard. Like, there's no way that you can step back and say, well, you know, that job's really easy, right? And part of it is recognizing that and getting that recognition throughout all parts of your organization. So why does this even matter? I'm going to take a wider view and talk a little bit about sort of the digital economy and what role we play. Because I feel like as systems administrators, as the people that, you know, see the sausage being made and are in the closet, you know, doing the day-to-day, we lose sight of just how important our role is, and we certainly never get thanked for it, right? No one's saying, you know, awesome job today, my mobile phone, I totally had, you know, access all day, it was awesome, right? My Facebook, I reloaded it, and it didn't go anywhere. It was always there, that was awesome, thanks. But if it's down, look in your face, right, constantly. So the digital economy plays a big part in that, and our role is increasingly tough. You have more day-to-day life is lived or augmented online, whether it's on your phone or whatever the case might be. The expanding reach of digital tools, partially because the cost is being driven down, the commoditization of that sort of digital access, and also globalization, right? So developing economies bring an entirely new perspective to the entire thing, right? So compared to, say, a generation ago, my mom worked for the phone company, because she started in the 60s when there was a phone company, and through the various iterations and the splits and then the reconvergence as what is now Verizon, ate like five other companies over the course of 20 years or whatever. So she saw a lot of that whole life cycle, because what she worked in was coin, right? Payphones. Oh, wow, where'd they go, right? They're, you know, somewhere in a dumpster. You see them very rarely. They've been completely replaced by this idea that we have access on our person at all time. And you still see them. Like, I take pictures of them and send them to her on her mobile phone, right? So she gets a text picture. Hey, I saw payphone today, right? Because I'm, you know, passive-aggressive like that. The reach of technology is a fascinating thing to sort of watch, right? In most countries in the West, in the U.S., it's to varying degrees, but, you know, we have connectedness as a near constant companion, right? We start to hear in the business news, well, you know, here's the prediction for XYZ company. They've actually reached market saturation in the U.S. Mobile phones, saturation in this demographic. Facebook, we're pretty sure they're not going to grow because they've reached saturation in this demographic. It's a constant stream of knowing that people are always connected. And the systems behind all these services are increasingly complex. They're interconnected. And the things that we need to know about them in order to make them function correctly and appropriately is just increasing astronomically. Users expect all the services to perform at a certain level. They're constantly refreshing, right? They want that thing to be there. When I worked at AOL years ago, you could see this on the metrics. If we had an outage or something happened and the page didn't load, and you saw the drop in page views, you immediately saw the echo as people were compulsively reloading that, looking for that traffic. And I think it was Amazon actually published a paper about this a number of years ago, that they see something similar when they have a sputter or an outage where you know, you see the drop, but overall, people are still there. They're just waiting. They're refreshing to find those things. So everybody's sort of sitting there waiting for all of the stuff that they expect to be there to perform that way. And it's not just like entertainment, it's not just TV, can I watch a football game on my phone? It's, you know, especially in urban environments, you're relying on things like Uber, Waze, which is, you know, tells me in near real time if there's a cop ahead or congestion in traffic or an accident or something like that. If you have food delivery through Seamless and Grubhub, which I think they're now combined, you can access your bank. Right, I moved to Seattle from Manhattan, right? And I've had the same bank for 14 years. And I didn't want to change banks. My bank is a huge global conglomerate, right? So when I go abroad, I can go to a local branch and get local cash, and that's awesome. I moved to Seattle. The closest local branch of my bank is in San Francisco. I don't care, right? I can get cash from Target when I make a purchase with my debit card. I can actually take a picture of my any check that I get and send it up to the bank, and all of those things are now part of my life. And you know, we're talking about sort of the evolution of that, like I hope that my nieces never have to write a paper check, right? Like all of those things are changing and moving, and part of those practices are going to go away, and we enable that, right? Like those of us sitting in this room keeping the lights on everywhere are part of that sort of revolution. Another aspect of this digital lifestyle that we have is the engagement with non-specialists. And part of the struggle here evolved out of that bastard operator from hell attitude. There's lots of stories, right? Like you have all kinds of derogatory titles for people who just don't get it, or whatever, muggles, etc. But the barrier to entry for actually accessing technical systems has been lowered, right? Thinking about even something like Salesforce. I have access to Salesforce on my phone. I don't have to be a technological whiz now to make queries and find information on these very sophisticated databases. Everything has now been pushed up to an abstract level that average users can really get a hold of it. And we have to then change the way that we engage with these folks, right? So in the past, you sort of ignore them and say, oh, well, you know, that's because you're dumb. Your printer doesn't work because you're dumb. Whatever your problem happens to be. But part of growing the businesses that we work for, you know, is expanding our audience and getting more of our products in the hands of more people. And that means, you know, expanding the reach. The folks aren't stupid, right? When you walk in to talk to your tax accountant or your dentist or your cardiologist, the first thing they don't say is, well, you're dumb because you don't know this. No, they're going to walk you through what they need you to know, what they need from you to help them help you. And that's the attitude we should take. It's a more customer service, more peer-to-peer conversation, right? Rather than sort of guru to novice. Globalization is an interesting one because when the systems that you support are available worldwide, I realize that not everyone's are. Emerging economies get to leapfrog over legacy infrastructure requirements. No one in the developing world really has to lay copper to get phone service. They start with mobile, right? So you don't have that last mile, that fiber to the door thing that was a huge debate in the US. Individuals then are able to find new ways and unique ways and inventive ways to use technology to better their lives. And as we worry about, you know, our bottom line for the systems that we support, there's also folks that may be depending on us and our services for their actual lives and livelihood. We've reached a point here in the West in particular that technology is basically ubiquitous. Escaping technology takes work. Getting yourself to a cash-only basis. You occasionally meet people, right, that don't use credit cards, that use some kind of check cashing service for their paychecks. I'm not even sure our paycheck processing place would do that. Like, everything's direct deposit, right? Like, he has very well documented his life as far as, you know, how he manages to escape that whole layer of the modern lifestyle. It takes work, right? Then the growth of technology means, you know, there's more opportunity for more people, and you get unlikely uses for technologies and improvements in interesting places. So a couple of those. The things that you know, we as systems gatekeepers, the sorts of things that we enable. Projects like NanoGanesh. This is a project from Tata Indicom in India. In one state in India, the villages are sort of clustered, and the people live in small groups in clusters. But the fields that they actually grow their food in are far away, tens of kilometers from where they might be. And while they have irrigation and, you know, those sorts of farming practices, the farmers would have to walk from where they lived in the village to their fields and back in order to water them. So several years ago, sort of experimenter, shadow inventor, right, decided, well, you know, I can call my phone. I have mobile service. So what would happen if I hooked my mobile phone up to my irrigation system? And now there's a product, and this came out in 2009, I believe, where there's a mobile device that attaches to irrigation systems. And the farmers then don't have to walk from their village to their fields in order to irrigate them. They call the mobile device, it turns on the irrigation system for them, right? So enabling, it's a matter of safety, it's a matter of livelihood, it's a matter of health over time, that they're not spending, you know, so much time walking between their village and their fields. There's also companies like CMEX, right? And CMEX is an interesting case study about logistics and the sort of mobilization of data, in that in the early part of the 2000s, they partnered with, I believe, Cisco. But they basically decided they wanted to do just-in-time delivery for cement. There is nothing more fundamentally physical than cement, right? It spins in a truck. You have to keep it stirred up. It only has a certain, you know, lifetime in that state before it sort of goes bad. It goes past the ability to be correct or whatever. And they went through a process where, you know, they put GPS in their trucks. They allow their contractors to order cement sort of just in time, so that when you are in a developing economy where the banking system may not be as stable and predictable as it is in our economy, where people get their money at 10 o'clock in the morning that they need to pour a foundation, they can call or request a cement truck and have their foundation poured that same day, right? So it actually then fosters an entire ecosystem around being able to cope with the unpredictabilities in other portions of the economy. And then there's other stuff going on, right? So, you know, GE has some advertisements out now about some of the things that they're doing in healthcare. There's lots of changes in education, health, safety, all of these other aspects of our lives that are being enhanced, changed by technology. The potential itself is pretty boundless, right? You start with even just the Internet of Things, you think, oh, I don't really need an internet on my toaster or whatever. But other places where, you know, something like Comcast's new products, where you can turn on and off your lights and things over their, you know, their bandwidth that they sell to you, like those kinds of products are very interesting. You also have sort of emerging idea of quantified self and, you know, data about you as a system, right? So I wear a Fitbit. My brother was having some cardiac problems. So his doctor basically gave him a heart rate monitor to wear. And he could access it over the internet, basically. It was attached to a mobile phone, and off it went, and he could watch when my brother was having trouble. Like, all of those things help make our lives better, but someone has to run the stuff on the back end. And it's awesome, right? There's also all kinds of emerging stories from the developing world about, using technology to help people who maybe can't read, don't have access to schooling, don't have access to healthcare, this sort of democratization of that layer of life. The thing to remember, though, is that there's no place for bastard operators from hell in this new world. When the systems that we are running and the things that we are, managing affect people's ability to survive, and increasingly they do, whether we know it really or not, like, taking that attitude that, I have to protect this and I'm not going to let anybody else know about it, it's not fair. It's not a good way to live your life, and it's certainly not going to help, your organization grow and be more supportive of these things. So how do we, sort of change our mindset and build ourselves into better people, but also better sysadmins, right? So some things that we're kind of bad at. Self-awareness is one, right? And I've talked about this in talks before, but knowing the sorts of things that are your hot button things, right? Like knowing what sets you off, knowing what your comfort zone is, knowing what your fears are. If you're afraid of losing your job, that affects how you do your job, right? Also knowing, your inhibitions and the things that make you really, really uncomfortable that may be preventing you from helping other groups as much as you could. There's also organizational awareness, and this is kind of an interesting one, in that, the org chart for your organization has some physical representation. There's boxes, and it's leaves and trees and all these things, and that tells you who's in charge on paper, but paying attention to the way the organization actually behaves is a whole other story. You may find that while someone is your boss, that you actually take more direction from a peer who you respect, and that organizational influence is really important as we are, melding ourselves into people who are more more facilitators than gatekeepers, and knowing who actually is setting our goals and where they're coming from and who has influence over that. The final one, sort of going from small to large, participation in the field, right? You're here, so that's a good step, right? You took the time to come to a conference, to learn about what everybody else is doing, what they're thinking, have conversations with people. Participate in the hallway track, right? Learn what other folks are doing, whether they're in the same field as you, whether you're in healthcare or education or whatever, or not. Like, we have things to teach each other so that everybody is not repeating the same things over and over again. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some new skills, and some of them aren't so new. But these are places where, because I interact with sysadmins, every week when I do trainings, which ends up being maybe twice a month, I meet like 12 to 20 new people in a class. So I start to see, trends around, our field and where folks could spend some time, right, getting a little bit better. So the first one is touch typing. And there are weeks when I wish Mavis Beacon was hanging out with me. And I've seen some crazy configurations of how people type. Two fingers? I understand two fingers. Confession time. Yes, in the back. Okay. I see two fingers. Last week, I saw two on the left hand, three fingers and a thumb on the right hand, and it was like very much a sort of like this. Very strange. Very strange. It's important. Like, ignore the history of the keyboard and the QWERTY versus Dvorak and all those sorts of things. You have 10 fingers. I use 9 of them, and I feel like I'm not getting the full power of the keyboard out of them. If you look at like professional musicians, right, especially woodwind players, saxophone, clarinet, flute, those instruments are built for people with 10 digits. And if you only use 6 of the digits, you're not getting the full use out of the instrument. The same way with your keyboard. So that's my screed on Learn to Type. The other one's next one's version control. A lot of history around version control, right? Like back in the day, we had RCS, there was the book, RCS and SCCS. And you know, it only took that one time where you checked some config file into RCS and forgot to leave a local copy, where you just kind of threw your hands in the air and said, all right, version control, not for me. My version control system is like a hand-carved date stamp. And then you have this huge directory structure of all these backup files. That's not a version control system. Not when someone else has to follow you into those systems, right? Modern tools like Git integrate with all kinds of other stuff, right? Super easy. There's web APIs, and you can use GitHub, or you can use on-premise, you can do whatever you need to. Easy to share with other people. It's important to have that history, not just for our software engineering buddies, right? Like, they want history in their code to see how changes were made, but you also want that history on your config side. You want to know why, you know, as much as possible, why changes were made, when changes were made, in case you're tracking down an outage, and the cause of something, right? All of those things are super important. It creates a single workflow for everyone, right? If you're including, you know, the configs for an application in with the application's code, all of that stuff can live together, and you create a life cycle for that actual, you know, device or that service that you're working on. My mantra is pull early, push often. Always keep your stuff up to date, right? This is the scariest slide in the talk. Learn to code. Tom Lemoncelli told you to do it, and that should be enough, right? That's probably all I needed to put on this slide, right? Pick a language and learn it. I don't care. Bash is cool. It does stuff. It does loops. It does if statements. If you live in Windows and you don't know PowerShell, man, you are missing out because it's kind of amazing, right? I think Tom actually specifically blogged about a Python class that's being taught here on site this week. Another, you know, another option. Somehow something got missed, right? Like I come from the generation of sysadmins who did everything in Perl. If there was a question to be asked, the answer was to be found in Perl. And you know, we boffed ourselves into not sharing that with the folks that came after, I guess is what happens there. But you want to be able to increase your efficiency, right? Like, most of us are in orgs where there's a finite number of headcount. We have two hands and one brain. And there's a limit to how much we can do. So over time, you know, we're creating reproducible workflows and doing things over and over again and make sure they're always done the same way. You accomplish that by having them in some kind of code. It's also a skill that you can learn. It's not magic. It's not talent, right? And you know, there's a whole discussion around the, and I'm going to go a little off track, but like the talking about skill versus talent and working with child development, right? So if you're talking about how kids perform in school and how they are encouraged to continue to learn, right? If you tell someone they're talented and they fail at something, it has a greater impact than if you tell them, you know, they're skilled and they learn something and then they fail at it, because there's an implicit idea behind being skilled that you can learn something and you can learn to improve it, versus the feeling that talent is innate and you were born with a finite amount of it. And if you have failed, you have reached the end of your talent. None of us was born knowing how to code. It's a skill that you can learn, right? And you can get better at it over time. So don't be afraid of it. The resources here are awesome. There's plenty of stuff online. Working in the cloud. I'm going to say that the cloud is our fault. The cloud exists because we said no too many times. And that's maybe that's a threatening statement for folks, right? To say that, you know, this whole idea of commodity computing, this off-premise sort of scary thing exists because we weren't able or willing to keep up with what the business needed. And The commoditization of this hardware layer has totally caught up with us. And for folks that are, you know, their joy is rack and stack and cable and zip tie, like, that's a hard thing, right? And if you work higher up the stack, there's new challenges to be learned. And you should totally learn to work on that stuff. It brings new challenges, it shines light on all of the what ifs, right, that we are always telling the business about. Well, you know, I understand you don't want to buy more replicates for this database, but there's going to come a time where you're going to need them. And that time may be when Amazon reboots all of your instances and things go bad, right? So it also can be used to sort of illustrate some of the things that we've been talking about. You can also use the cloud to learn new things, right? It lowers the barrier to entry because you don't have to have an entire rack of gear in your closet. If you do, that's awesome. It's fantastic. I like my, you know, my temperature in my apartment to be pretty cool, so I don't have any gear anymore. It's all in the cloud. If I need to learn MongoDB for a client or whatever, I can fire up an instance, spend $5, and learn some MongoDB on that system, right? And I don't have to maintain all that extra gear. So for folks that are, you know, new to systems administration, you want to encourage them, like, that gives them a playground. It's a safe sandbox where they can do whatever they need to do. Another one's documentation systems. And getting beyond just writing the documents. If you write documents and you post them on the wall in the closet, like, no one's ever going to see them. So you have to have some kind of methodology for sharing the documentation that you're writing. And you want to be able to, you know, foster transparency, but also build trust. If people know exactly what you're doing and what their requests actually require you to do, like, that builds a better conversation around around requirements. If their team doesn't have or like wikis, that's fine. You can use something like Sphinx, right, which is a Python-based system. It uses MD markup. You build HTML, PDFs, LaTeX, all kinds of other processors and build into it so you can do whatever you need to with those documents. You give everyone access, right? Everyone should be able to read everything that you write about the systems that you work on. You want requests to come to you in a cohesive format, then you have to tell people what that format needs to be and what you need to know from them. Finally, testing and code review. So this is sort of an emerging topic, and I'm coming at this from the sort of infrastructure as code sort of area of practice where, you know, everything we do is some piece of code that then gets run on the systems. And there's a set of emerging tools, things like ServerSpec, that allow you to, before you ever get ready to push new config to production, to actually test what the effect is going to be. And this will continue to evolve. Like, if you have the time to sort of take a look at the sort of emerging space here, it's super interesting in that, you know, you're moving quickly, you have limited resources, you know, it's super hard to hire, so you don't have a junior person right now, but you can actually test your work going forward. Another thing is code review, and this is a tough one for, especially for folks who sort of live and work on their own, right? They're the only sysadmin in the house. And I say often enough that, you know, you're not necessarily a team of one, you're a team of yourself right now, yourself at 3 a.m. and yourself in a month, right? So you still want to produce things that are legible and have meaning down the road. And it helps to have someone else look at that. If you work closely with development teams who practice code review, you know, it's not just, oh, somebody looked at that thing and checked the box and off it went. You can actually have a discussion. Well, you know, why are you using this API this way? You know, why are we changing this config for the number of threads on this server? Like, what's the actual need here? And you can really start to get into better discussions on organizational needs and goals and things like that. So the common thread through all of these is to start taking a more proactive view of our role and our participation in technology in general, right? Being able to say yes as often as we can is super helpful. It's super empowering, actually, right? Because there's a very negative feeling around saying no, but if I can say yes, like, that feels good. And if you can't say yes right away, ask questions to avoid saying no, right? So if someone comes to you and says, you know, dude, I totally need a pony, I need it deployed, let's go. And instead of saying, well, no, you crazy bugger, you can't have a pony, you start to ask questions, you know, right, what color do you want the pony to be? Where do you want the pony to be deployed? When do you actually need this pony? And you can get down to what they're actually after, and maybe it's not as crazy as you thought, right? Maybe it's not actually pony, maybe it's just a firewall request, right? So, but you would never know that if your first answer is no and they walk away. So engaging that conversation. All right, so where are we going? So we're battling the cost, the legacy cost of systems with things like cloud and other services, right? So we're battling that original cost. We are battling the cost of our previous bad behaviors, right? We are trying to build ourselves some new reputation and become better participants in the organization. And we are going to work on getting to yes when people ask us for things. We're going to battle the cost of information hoarding and reinventing the wheel, that opportunity cost that gets lost when somebody has to redo something that you already did because you don't feel like telling them about it. And we're gonna be open and share all the knowledge that we've gained because we're smart people, we've learned stuff, it's awesome. Some of the things we do are totally cool and we should definitely be telling people about them. So the lesson today, folks, is that we can build amazing things, but it's no longer a place where we can build them all by ourselves. And we're going to be out there breaking down silos, working with people with different operational expertise. We're all on the same team, right? Your organization has more than one technologist in it, for most of you. Even if you don't have more than one technologist, you have other people who care about the outcomes of the work that you're doing. And we should be able to engage with those people. So some people already are starting to live this, right? I talk to customers on a regular basis, and they're in various stages of all these skills and all these workflows. The future for us as a field, as a community of practice, is already starting to be here for people. And it's definitely not evenly distributed, right? I still talk to folks who, you know, they may actually work for a hardware vendor, and it takes 6 weeks to get gear, right? So, and all they have to do is truck it from the factory to the data center, and it's really maybe a quarter of a mile. All those things still exist, so we're still getting there, while there are other folks that are doing continuous deployments, they're doing continuous delivery of their applications. So it's not that, you know, everyone has all these new practices yet, and what kind of emerges as a subtext to all this is a bit of shame and reluctance around actually even the title of sysadmin. Right? So you'll be in a room, you know, in the next few days with people who no longer call themselves systems administrators because there's a lot of bad juju around that, right? You have organizations that have renamed different parts of their technology team SREs or their application engineers or, you know, their systems people or whatever their title now is because they're trying to break away from this legacy and move into the future, right? And that's kind of hurtful, right? Because, you know, we were sysadmins back in the day, and it used to be awesome. And unfortunately, we created for ourselves something that is maybe a little bit bad feeling for people. So next steps, and you know, like things that I keep an eye on, and you know, folks like Tom blog about, and you know, other things that come up. You know, looking at what our first principles are as systems administrators, as technical people, what do we expect someone walking in the door to know right off the bat? What are the best things that we can tell people when we want to encourage them to sort of follow our path in life? We're also rejecting the pool of the bastard operator from hell. This is a lifelong struggle, I feel, right? There probably needs to be a 12-step program for recovery from boffing. We also want to refocus our system work on enabling organizations to do great things. There's a lot of really interesting stuff happening out there, and If we get bogged down with the minutia of, you know, adding new users to hosts, we start to lose sight of that, and it takes away from the actual joy of doing the work that we do. And finally, we're going to have to sort of relocate or refine our value proposition in a lot of the organizations we work in, because we have built ourselves sort of into a corner with, you know, bad reputation and things like that. And so now that we're not the guardians of large, expensive systems, we are going to be able to change our role into being the facilitators of large, amazing ideas, right? Why? Someday, I want to go to space, right? There's going to be sysadmins on those starships running life support systems, and that is going to be super important. And there will be no bastard operator from hell running my oxygen system, right? So, that's all I have to say. We have plenty of time for questions. If anybody has any, or if anyone has any other things to sort of add. There's a, yeah, use the mic there so everyone can sort of hear.
Hi, Garrett Wallman from MIT. My organization doesn't have the sort of reputation that maybe some people do. And I attribute that to my, well, 15 years ago, my then boss came up with a slogan, which was, yes when we can, no when we mean it.
Ooh.
We try always to give people what they ask for, if what they're asking for is actually reasonable, even if it's not the thing we necessarily want to do, because the fewer times they say no, or we say no, the more likely they are to believe us when they're actually asking for something that's really wrong.
That's a good point. You cry wolf too many times with your no, right?
David Lynn, Vanderbilt University, and perhaps more importantly, I'm on the north side of 50. So I've been in long enough. I use Emacs and Vi. I use C Shell and Bourne Shell and Corn Shell and Bash and all these other things. And I did pick Perl, and then everything went to Python. But mm-hmm. I didn't know if it's going to be Python or Ruby. And I do use SCCS still. Because was it mercurial or bizarre? Or
yeah, originally.
What was it going to be? Mm-hmm. How do you recover from being, having made the wrong choice and being deeply invested in the technology that got abandoned?
There's two pieces there, right? There's the sort of emotional tie you have to something that you've invested in, and the sort of pragmatic realization that, like, I love this thing and it didn't win, right? And part of it is, you know, the sort of almost trite answer is, like, everything is an opportunity to learn. And the things that you learn in one programming language are still going to be applicable for a lot of other modern languages. So I learned Perl, but when I moved to, I'm still not really a Ruby programmer. Our tool just happens to be built in Ruby. But at the same time, like, important pieces of Ruby borrow a lot of things from Perl. Because back in Ruby's history, it was meant to be a prototype for big, complex Perl systems, right? And the regular expression parser and lots of other things borrow from those languages. So it starts to feel comfortable. Every now and then, I miss my dollar signs. But, you know, there's other things there that feel the same. And, you know, it's part of having a career, that over time things aren't exactly the way they were when you first entered the field. And that's true of everyone, right? My dad's an auto mechanic. And, you know, when he started working on cars in the 60s, they're way different from, you know, where he retired from UPS a couple years ago, working on package trucks that now have all this digital equipment in them and tracking and all these other systems for, you know, managing the profitability of the trucks. So it's hard to say, but, you know, you have to embrace it. And if you don't love that learning anymore, like, maybe it's time to find something else to do, right? Move to Washington, grow pot? I don't know.
Is there still a good market in BC? Because it's still illegal in BC, right? So it's good margins. The margins going out of that business.
Oh,
fast.
Totally. It's the bottom's going to fall out of it. Absolutely.
It's a disaster. In follow-up to this question, and I think that was a really good answer, I think one of the approaches is don't pick the wrong thing. And that sounds trite, but like I worked with a sysadmin who in 2002 decided that was a really good time to start moving to corn shell. Like, and the rest of us were like, but bash, I mean bash, and there's also bash. And she was like, no man, corn shell, I'm gonna get a book and I'm gonna spend a lot of time. I'm gonna learn it. I'm like, really? Right now is the moment. So I think sometimes we do this naturally with lots of things, but you gotta give a lot of privilege to momentum. Like you pick the thing that's got the momentum.
Yeah.
So I really liked your talk. I think it's I think the most important thing you said is that people need to learn to code because it's all software all the way down. And the number of people in this role who don't have software skills is approximately correlated with the number of people who won't be in this role in 10 years.
Absolutely. Okay, learn assembly, man. I learned assembly on a VAX. And like that is totally cheating because Digital was totally notorious for putting all kinds of crazy functionality in their assembly language, so it's not actually really assembly. If you can do fast Fourier transforms in the hardware, it's not really assembly. It's totally cheating.
Hey, I'm Matt. I'm not going to name where I work because it's kind of a negative question, but what's your suggestion for battling culturally ingrained lack of interest in new technologies?
Quit your job.
Okay. I'm serious. I mean, because I work with, I'd like to think I'm not a BOF, but I definitely know they exist, and I work
absolutely
with a couple, and changing the culture is actually the biggest challenge I see.
Mm-hmm.
How do you suggest attacking?
Culture's tough, and if you talk to Jen, like she will refer you to my Velocity talk from last year. I think she's downloaded it like 500 times, but cultural change is super, super tough because people are messy, right? And part of it is part of its influence, and part of it is, you know, the effect we're able to have from our position in the larger organism. And for folks who are individual contributors, even line managers, like the ability to facilitate larger change in huge organizations is almost minuscule. Like I come across folks who have like these weird little skunkworks projects and they're like doing their thing, they're doing DevOps in the corner, right? And some new thing comes on from on high and stomps them. And you know, it's frustrating, absolutely. To really have true cultural change, you have to have executive buy-in. Like it has to be supported because part of changing culture is really the things that give you meaning and the your values and your goals. And the people that have the most effect on that and can most reward the positive changes there are executives. And if you see your executives, you know, holding on to the 70s, right? They're in their TARDIS and they are back somewhere else. If you have it, and it's sort of a privileged statement to say, but leaving the organization and finding somewhere that embraces the culture that you want is easier than trying to change from the bottom up.
So I heard a lot that I really, really liked. I've got like 20 things I'm going to have to follow up with you, but some stuff that really rung in with me was when you're talking about people who don't learn from the lessons of the past. I was chatting to one of the program committee, actually, and, you know, young guy, really, really smart, pretty awesome, and he was trying to describe how he was having problems replacing an older system. And I was like, yeah, it's second system syndrome, and I smiled, and he went, what? Yeah, second system syndrome. You've read Brooks, right? And he went, what? So he hadn't even heard of Brooks. He kind of heard of the book when I mentioned it, but only knew of that one bit. And it was like, no, but you're missing all of our language.
Oh, yeah.
How you can explain 10 years of pain and suffering in 3 words. And that kind of made me sad. When I was here last year, actually, one of the most horrific things that I heard was the most important thing it is to learn as a sysadmin is how to drill a hole in a data center wall.
Oh, dude.
I was, what? Oh, yeah, you know, we were trying to get a link put in, and they said we couldn't, whatever. So I just got a giant big drill and drilled a hole in that wall in the evening when no one's around. I ran the cable myself. It wasn't just that. It was. And what about like the building codes that you've now weakened the data center wall? You know, great, there wasn't a gas duct or a power duct, and it was all these things. And he thought that was the most important thing. It was like, no, why not find out why they can't run the cable? Maybe there's a perfectly reasonable explanation.
Absolutely.
And that just terrified me.
There are a lot of posers. Are they posers or are they not necessarily wannabes, but like... The analogy I use is Plato's Cave, and I'm going to get a little meta on you here, right? So, and I apologize, I have my MBA hat on, but like, there's a certain amount of perception, right? And perception as a filter, everyone has their own personal filter, and there's also institutional filters. But at the same time, like, the image that we project as professionals has an effect on the people who are not in our field, right? And part of that is, you know, they're not necessarily posers, but they see that attitude and they see those behaviors, and that is, you know, you get the high fives from everyone else, you know, when you talk about, you know, being mean to users or creating the buff flail, which is the thing with the RJ45. Oh, it's horrible. But, you know, that perception leads to, you know, attraction of certain people, right? And that brings, you know, the entire field down, really. Grouch is a skill, man. That's awesome.
In the new world, yeah. Those jobs are going away.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't have a lot of data on systems administration in general. On the web operations side, which is sort of my part of the house, is, you know, where a lot of us came from was we're all the same age, right? We all came out of ISPs. And it's almost a cliche. If you meet someone who's currently in web operations, the chance that they started at an ISP in the late 90s, whether they're in high school or college or whatever, like somewhere north of 85% of the time, that's where we came from. And so there's that part of it's, you know, it breeds that same mentality. Everybody's sort of like we're a cohort. And, you know, we're a tribe, and it's a little weird, and it's super hard for people to break into that, right? And as far as systems administration in general goes, I don't have enough data, I think, to figure out, like I have a CS degree, I have two, actually, but, like, the folks that I meet from day to day, a lot of them don't. And I'm not sure if that's the folks that have self-selected in to the certain kind of work that I do, or if it was just that... that more welcoming aspect of technology that you maybe felt like they didn't have to have a CS degree. It'd be interesting to really dig into. And you know, I'm sure Usenix would have the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. That we all kind of acknowledge as part of the growing up we did, which no longer happens because a lot of that web is outsourced, mm-hmm. a lot of that web is cloud.
Yep.
So that ladder, whether we pulled it up or whether someone's taken it away, it's gone. And we haven't quite learned the skills of how to bridge the gap from the generation living in the JRE for the last 5 years to us. And it's a constant problem.
I love that taking the ladder up analogy. I'm totally stealing that. Good stuff. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll attribute it, and I'll give you a portion of my proceeds. Okay.
IT has always been a cost.
Yeah.
And now they want us to be, they want us to go out into like sales and into and be integrated into providing value.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any ideas how that can be benchmarked or?
Oh, benchmarking it. I'm not sure I can. I have a good way of like putting metrics and things around that. Like, the idea of changing sort of operations tasks from cost center to value center is has actually been a pretty big deal over the last 4 or 5 years. There's been quite a bit of talk about it, and the unfortunate part is like there's very little of like actual legitimate case studies on how you really go about this, and some of it is, you know, totally dependent on the part of the economy that you're in, because it's kind of easy to say, well, you know, in web operations, you can translate, you know, better speed, better performance of systems into more clicks, into more page views, into more turnover, into, you know, people who buy stuff from you or see your ads or, you know, those kinds of things. But, you know, other systems, like when you're managing something like educational outcomes or transportation and those sorts of things, like I don't have enough view into the fields to really give you a good baseline. I would talk to your executives, right? Like anybody who has, you know, at a certain level, everybody has a P&L, and they're all managing to some bottom line. And they should know, if they're good managers, what variables feed into those, right? So they know, like, you know, better customer engagement at this point leads to more engagement later, and we are more likely to get a sale out of those folks. And so, you know, injecting yourself into those points where, you know, they know that that's the fulcrum for better sales or better customer engagement is good. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's an awesome skill to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's like synergies of what you got to do. I mean, proactively.
Yeah.
You need to understand what your business does and what their pain points are at the top. Because if you do, then you can figure out where I can.
The difficulty is about my own man.
So I'm standing in front of the microphone, so I get to talk.
Oh, shoot. Hey, Jen.
So one of the things that I'm noticing is that economies of scale, services, systems are getting cheaper, and more companies are building. And this may be like a Silicon Valley bubble, but I'm meeting small companies where the executives no longer call IT systems as a cost. Like Lookout is a really great example of this. I've had really great conversations with those people. And I think that the maturity of organizations and companies that are actually transitioning to this are going to just overtake the big companies that are slow and consider things that like IT and system administration as a cost rather than a value. So I would say kind of the thing about like cultures, this is one of those things you need to examine. We don't, you as an individual do not want to be left behind in this sort of, in like the dinosaur stage of like IT is a cost, culture, the bastard operator from hell, the hate driven organizations or the power driven organizations. I see a change, and it's either learn the new skills, be adaptable, understand your value, you as an individual, or you are not gonna have a job in 10 years or whatever somebody said earlier. So that was my contribution. Sorry, I'm talking about dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Another way to learn what the business is doing. If they don't want you to specifically do that,
Awesome. Oh, one more? Sneaking in before the line.
Do you have an opinion on the quality of today's degree educations, the specialized in system and network administration? Are you familiar with them?
So full disclosure, I have an article coming out any day now from O'Reilly about this topic. So I did do some research several months ago on, you know, some of the things that are now available that weren't available years ago, right? So I have a traditional computer science degree. So I did do some looking into what are sort of termed the systems administration, network administration sort of things. And, you know, and I'm a vendor, right? So I work for a vendor. We sell product. But at the same time, when I'm looking at those projects and I'm looking at those courses, the last thing I want to see is sponsored by some big hardware or software vendor that sort of get them in the cradle. It's like Catholicism. They're Catholic before they're born. You know, they're Microsoft people before they even know how to type. And I think that's a huge disservice to the industry in general. Having said that, though, there's a couple of emerging ones, and I don't remember them off the top of my head. Carolyn actually might know, because this is sort of, you know, in her wheelhouse, that there are some that are a little bit more generalized. I think it's going to be an evolution. Part of it is that if you're talking about a four-year degree, like there are 120 hours in the U.S. in a four-year degree, and 60 of whatever of them have to be in the field. So that's like 20 some odd classes or whatever it is. And, you know, creating that content in a way that is, it produces measurable outcomes to be accredited, right? So that it's all these layers upon layers of challenges, right? And it's emerging. There's a couple of them that are pretty good. There's some that are pretty questionable. As a foundation, what I find is that for folks who have little to no exposure to technology as children, that they're a good place to start, right? And, you know, one of my personal pet peeves is when someone tells me they've been programming since they were 7 years old. There's an awful lot of privilege sort of packed into that one simple sentence. That means that your parents were wealthy enough in the early 80s to have a computer, right? I got a computer as my graduation present from high school. I got on the internet when I got to college, right? So, like, having that early exposure for those sorts of people, they don't need degrees, probably. Like, they have all that. It's part of their life now. But for folks who are coming from, you know, less privileged backgrounds, urban backgrounds, even I grew up in a rural area. We didn't have computers at the school. You know, those places are, and those programs are, I think, a helpful stepping stone if they're done right. Some of them are good. Some of them are bad. Carolyn, maybe you can give us some some insight on her side.
I feel really short. So there are a lot of degree programs that are starting up, not a lot, some that are starting up. RIT has a program that's been around a long time. Michigan Tech University has a program that's been around several years. Wentworth in Boston, and of course Oslo University in Norway. Those are the four really solid ones that I know of. And in Amsterdam, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. There's like 25, but those are the ones I'm really familiar with because I know people personally from those. Even though, were you in CISA? Were you at? Okay. There was a room, like 25 people at a summit on Tuesday to talk about education programs for system administration.
Yeah, it sounded like you're really
real. It was very cool because the room was full. There are a lot of people that are interested in developing programs, and they understand that there's this measurable outcomes required. They're talking about how to teach, not the technology, but the thinking so that the people that come out of those programs have the skills to adapt to technology, which is one of the challenges of getting a four-year degree, that it could be stale by the time you get it. One of the things I think a four-year degree provides is your parents want you to go to college. You want to be an operations person. Oh my gosh, you don't have to get a degree that is totally unrelated to what your passion is. You can get a degree that's related, and now you have a four-year degree that has given you some foundation that you can go out and say, hey, look, I have this certificate that says I've been exposed to this way of thinking. I have a foundation, and I made my parents happy.
You can minor in theater and basket weaving and whatever other things you're interested in.
Yeah, maybe. Right? But I think there's a place for these degree programs. I also think that A lot of us were self-taught. There was no degree program when I came through. So that is also a valid way of learning. So there are multiple paths, but I think these degree programs have a purpose.
Oh yeah.
John Looney just... Well, that's when you're hiring. Yeah. But somebody who learns Python and understands why Python is important and how to construct good Python can adapt with the next Python that comes along. And that's what's
Absolutely.
Important.
Yep.
And if somebody's getting a four-year degree and they're interested in this topic, I would think that they're going to be working along the way. They're going to be doing more than just going to class and doing their homework. They're going to be learning on the side. I mean, when we were coming through, we were eating this stuff up. As soon as something new came out, we were like, oh my gosh, I have to learn this. This is so cool. These are the people we're going to hire, not the people that say, oh, I went and I got a degree and I did nothing else. And some of the strongest IT operations people that I've seen can code. They're developers first and then they're operations people.
Yeah. If you sit and watch someone on the Windows side who really knows PowerShell, like the amazing stuff that you can do, like I was stupefied. Like I hired a Windows guy intentionally in August for my team. And like my Windows experience stopped with NT351 and T4. Like that was it. And to sit and watch him get all this information out of the system using PowerShell, like that's incredible. And you know, it's a high bar to cross now, I think, for some folks that are coming in, but it has to be done. Absolutely. All right, we're off time. So thanks.